safeguards issues, this topic seems to be a major sticking point, blocking an agreement in the ongoing Vienna talks. And as Grossi described, it's intertwined with the fate of the discussions in Vienna.
They are very closely interrelated, and it would be difficult to believe or to imagine that such an important return to such a comprehensive agreement like Barjam would be possible if the agency and Iran would not be seeing eye to eye on how to resolve these important safeguards issues.
Iran has vehemently dismissed the IAEA's safeguards narrative as a political claim, calling on the nuclear watchdog to stick to its technical task and avoid being influenced by, quote, political lobbying.
I urge Mr. Grossi that political influence and lobbying should not impact the decisions of the IAEA. Iran and the IAEA should follow their issues in a completely professional way and behave within the framework of expertise.
Grossi's visit to Tehran is seen as a major push to sort out the last differences in the Austrian capital, which has hosted numerous rounds of talks to remedy the crippled 2015 deal. In 2018, then-US President Donald Trump pulled Washington out of the accord and reinstated sanctions against Iran. Tehran, in return, scaled back its compliance with part of the agreement. Both Grossi and the Iranian atomic chief agreed that their meeting was fruitful. This could mean that another roadblock has been removed, and negotiators in Vienna will only have to cross the T's before a final conclusion is reached. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
EU foreign affairs ministers held yet another emergency meeting on Friday evening in Brussels to take stock of many Ukraine-related issues. The flow of refugees into EU nations was discussed at length. The impact of recently announced Western sanctions on Russia was assessed.
We are not under regime change. The sanctions are not in order to provoke a regime change in Russia.
Borrell says these sanctions are in fact designed to end the deadly conflict. NATO foreign ministers also met on Friday and reaffirmed their stance of not being drawn into the war. They acknowledged the results could be catastrophic. However, NATO allies continue to send thousands of additional troops into eastern parts of the 30-nation alliance.
And we have over 130 jets at high alert and over 200 ships from the high north to the Mediterranean.
Experts say the US is controlling all of the West's next moves, and the decision to supply deadly arms to Ukraine was a mistake.
The Europeans are saying to the Ukrainian, we're not going to send men to fight with you, we're not going to fight by your side, we give you weapons for you to fight. And had that not happened, President Zelensky would have talked to Russia from day one and avoided this war.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken attended all of the key events in Brussels on Friday, focusing on Ukraine.
Unfortunately, tragically, horrifically, this may not be over soon. And so these efforts that we're making together, we have to sustain them.
A number of political commentators are saying this crisis could have been averted if Russia's legitimate security concerns had been listened to. Therefore, they suggest the onus is now on Western leaders to bring about de-escalation as a matter of urgency. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
This is IRIB English Radio. website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Muhammad al-Ghahtani has spent 20 years at the US military prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, where he was tortured so badly that he was ineligible to be tried at a war crimes court. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Carol Rosenberg. The piece is titled, 20th Hijacker is Returned to Saudi Arabia for mental health care. The Biden administration on Monday, 7th of March, repatriated to Saudi Arabia for mental health care a prisoner who had been tortured so badly by U.S. military interrogators that he was ruled ineligible for trial as the suspected would-be 20th hijacker in the 11th of September 2001 attacks. The prisoner, Muhammad al-Ghahtani, in his 40s, is the second to be transferred from the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba under the Biden administration. A government panel recommended recently that Mr. Ghahtani, who had spent 20 years at Guantanamo Bay, be released after a Navy doctor advised that he was too impaired to pose a future threat, particularly if he was sent to inpatient mental care. The doctor last year upheld an independent psychiatrist's finding that Mr. Ghahtani suffered from schizophrenia and post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, and could not receive adequate care at the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay. His long-serving lawyer, Shayana Kadidal of the Center for Constitutional Rights, said the transfer was long overdue. For 14 years, I've sat across from Muhammad al-Ghahtani as he talks to non-existent people in the room and makes eye contact with the walls, something that's been a constant part of his life since his teenage years. Mr. Kadidal said, "It's an extraordinary relief that the next time the voices in his head tell him to swallow a mouthful of broken glass, he'll be in a psychiatric facility and not a prison." Mr. Ghahtani's case was controversial to the end. Three Republican senators asked the president last week in a letter to halt all transfers from Guantanamo Bay, and in particular, to keep Mr. Ghahtani at the prison. "We are concerned that he may try to resume terrorist activities once released from U.S. custody," wrote Senators James Inhofe of Oklahoma, Jim Reich of Idaho, and Marco Rubio of Florida. The U.S. military airlifted Muhammad al-Ghahtani from remote Guantanamo on Sunday, 6th of March 2022. Soon after the clock ran out on the 30 days' notice Congress requires for a detainee transfer. In an unusual move, the Saudi Arabian government did not send its own aircraft to retrieve him, which delayed the announcement of his release until the US military transfer operation was complete. Mr. Ghahtani's notoriety is linked to his attempt to enter the United States on 4th of August 2001, when an immigration inspector at the airport in Orlando, Florida, turned him away. US authorities later discovered that he was to be met there by Muhammad al-Attar, a ringleader of the 9/11 attacks that were carried out by 19 hijackers and killed nearly 3,000 people in four almost simultaneous hijackings the next month. Mr. Ghahtani found his way to Afghanistan and was captured along the Pakistani border in late 2001. At a US military prison at Guantanamo Bay, the US military isolated him while nude, disoriented him, and he was sleep-deprived in a wooden hut at Camp X-Ray in late 2002 and early 2003, and questioned him brutally and relentlessly. A senior Bush administration official later concluded that the torture made him ineligible for prosecution. Later, his lawyers disclosed that he had sustained a traumatic brain injury as a youth in Saudi Arabia and then was diagnosed with schizophrenia there, circumstances that also could have made him ineligible for trial. The transfer follows the repatriation in July of a Moroccan man, Abdel Latif Nasser, whose release was mostly arranged in the dwindling days of the Obama administration, but was never acted upon by the Trump administration. In a statement announcing Mr. Ghahtani's release from Guantanamo Bay, the Pentagon thanked Saudi Arabia and other partner countries for supporting U.S. efforts to reduce the prison population, with the goal of ultimately closing the facility. After two decades of indefinite detention, Muhammad al-Ghahtani finally has a chance to heal from the torture he suffered, received mental health care Guantanamo can't provide, and hopefully one day reclaim his life, said Scott Rome, the Washington director of the Center of Victims Against Torture. Scott Rome added, his transfer is a welcome incremental step, but the Biden administration needs to act much faster and more comprehensively to close Guantanamo than it has so far. The transfer left 38 detainees at Guantanamo, half of them approved for release if the State Department can reach security agreements with receiving countries that satisfy the Secretary of Defense. Of the rest, 12 have been charged with war crimes, including two men who have been convicted. The other seven men are held as law of war prisoners, essentially detained indefinitely because the United States considers them too dangerous to release them. Their cases are reviewed periodically by a US government panel, which can recommend a transfer with certain security measures, including restrictions on travel or to detention in overseas prisons.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, commonly known as NATO, is notorious for its military intervention around the world in the past decades, from Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya to former Yugoslavia, with millions of people falling victim to its operations. NATO's eastward expansion has caused growing frictions with Russia recently, a plan that Moscow regards as a threat to its existence. And now with the current conflict between Russia and Ukraine, NATO's stated goal of maintaining peace and security on the international stage has come under question. Now, this edition of Spotlight will take a look at NATO's past and current positions, its failures and challenges, and try to figure out to what extent it could be blamed for the current crisis in Ukraine. Hello and welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let's see who's going to join us in this edition of the Spotlight. We'll have David Swanson, director of the World Beyond War from Charlottesville. Also joining us will be Mike Harris, editor of the Veterans Today in Phoenix, Arizona.
Is the Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to the Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show. Now, David, to begin with, let's take a look back at history. NATO was structured around anti-Soviet aims some 70 years ago, as you know, to contain threats from the Warsaw Pact and the Communist bloc. Now, with the collapse of the Iron Curtain after 1989, many predicted that NATO would disintegrate, but it didn't happen. Why?
Well, you know, the Warsaw Pact has been gone for 30 years, and that was the moment for NATO to be dismantled and shut down. It obviously wouldn't self-disintegrate. Someone had to do it, and the courage and the sensibility were not there. In large part because the stated purpose was to keep Russia out, keep the United States in, and keep Germany down. And those two goals of keeping the United States in Europe and keeping Germany down didn't go anywhere. And there was a fortune to be made in selling weapons to Eastern Europe if NATO could expand. And so promises were made, let Germany reunify, NATO won't expand an inch eastward. And the promises were broken. When Bill Clinton was president, you had three countries added. When George W. Bush was president, another seven, and two more countries each for Obama and Trump, with no end in sight.
Okay. Now, Mike, let's review some Bashnita operations around the world. Let's start with Libya. Then U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said that NATO was responsible to enforce a no-fly zone and to protect civilian lives. But on the ground, what happened was that the mission turned out to be aimed at regime change, and which, as you saw, brought chaos to the country, not democracy. And it's still, you know how things are in Libya. So let's have your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, Hillary Clinton has been a very destructive force within U.S. politics for a very long time. She seems to have the fecal touch. Everything she touches turns very bad. So that being given, what happened in Libya was a crime against humanity here, where they went in and destabilized a regime that was promoting peace and wealth and prosperity throughout Africa, putting out the African currencies on a gold standard, which threatened the Western banking interests. That is the one thing that no country is allowed to do, is either resist or threaten banking interests of the West. So that's why Libya was destroyed, and that was an unmitigated failure. In addition to which, there's great support for the speculation that Hillary Clinton and others within the U.S. Department of State were trafficking weapons through Libya intended to be put into Syria to topple the Bashar al-Assad regime. So there's a lot of hijinks and a lot of exploitation of other countries going on out there, where the U.S. wants to destabilize these up-and-coming regimes and topple them, bring chaos in so that they can't organize and can't form any sort of cogent resistance against them. Then the resources of that country are laid wide open for any U.S. company or any Western company that wants to come in and exploit them. So really, this is very financially oriented, and it's really piracy by sovereign states. And that's what the U.S. has been doing for some time. And NATO is essentially a tool of the U.S. State Department.
Mm-hmm. Now, David, we can also mention NATO-led operations in Afghanistan, you know, which have in most cases resulted in the killing of a large number of civilians and failed to achieve its goals. And Western forces left Afghanistan in a humiliating way, and they left a legacy of simply further misery for Afghans. Your thoughts on that?
No question, and ongoing and being exacerbated, and many, many men, women, and children threatened with starvation due to the theft of funds. This is a problem that needs addressing immediately. NATO, in the minds of many people in the United States, is some sort of an international body, vaguely like the United Nations, which they've vaguely heard of. And so there's this idea that if you have a large enough gang engaged in a crime, it's sort of legalistic-ish. The United States loves to call wars NATO wars rather than U.S. wars, and can persuade people that therefore they are legal and acceptable and respectable. And of course, this is not the case. NATO is the very madness that created World War One. NATO now engages in these, you know, foreign imperial wars and destructive pseudo-humanitarian bombings, but NATO, what it was supposed to be, when people say get NATO back to its original purpose, it was supposed to be the madness that created World War One, the agreement to jump into any wars that any other NATO members get in. Which is, of course, why NATO doesn't actually want Ukraine in NATO anytime soon, why no country has the right to join NATO, because you don't have the right to compel a bunch of other countries to join in all of your wars. Not only was NATO used to go after Libya, and not only does NATO shield the U.S. Military from investigations by Congress when Congress finds the spine to do any such thing because they just passed the buck to NATO, but the lawyer that President Barack Obama used to sell Congress and the U.S. public on the legality of attacking Libya appeared yesterday at the International Court of Justice to represent Ukraine, arguing for the illegality of Russia attacking a sovereign state. Mm-hmm. Russia didn't show up, by the way. So the hypocrisy, it could not be more stark.
Okay. Now, Mike, let's turn to the former Yugoslavia and see what NATO did there. We have reports of, the bombing killing 500 civilians there, infrastructure in ruins, the schools, hospitals were razed. Also in Kosovo, the bombing lasted 3 months before the war came to an end. The legitimacy of NATO air campaign in Kosovo has been questioned, so has the number of civilian casualties in there. And also we have the UN International Criminal Tribunal for former Yugoslavia establishing NATO's use of depleted uranium and cluster bombs in its military intervention in Yugoslavia in 1999.
Well, the U.S. has a history of using depleted uranium in Iraq as well, particularly in Fallujah. And as a result, that area is going to be the quality of life that's possible there, capable there, has been greatly depleted. The same thing going for Kosovo. NATO is really a U.S. proxy. U.S. calls the shot. U.S. pays the bill. Remember Donald Trump coming out and saying that the NATO countries aren't paying their fair share. They've got to pay their fair share. Remember Donald Trump also calling for the dissolution of NATO. because the whole mandate of why NATO exists was to contain the Soviet Union and their westward expansion. NATO was there to stop that. Well, the Soviet Union doesn't exist, and there are elements within our State Department, particularly Zionist elements, that wish to recreate the Cold War situation that we had back then, because that was good business for them. It's not good for the American people. It's not good for the people of Europe. The real elegant solution to what's going on now is to dissolve NATO and invite Russia and Ukraine both into the EU and make it sort of a more of a commercial pact versus a defensive pact. So there's many eloquent workarounds here. But, like I said, NATO has been out of control for some time and has been acting as a U.S. proxy. And it's time to hold the U.S. State Department and our government officials, who proceed through multiple administrations, and hold them accountable for what is in the best interest of the American people. That is where our Department of State seems to have lost its way, and they seem to be serving another master, which is not what we're set up to do as a country, how our republic is organized. But we seem to be more of a vassal state for a little small sliver of a country down in the eastern Mediterranean someplace that has an inordinate amount of influence over all of American policy. And this has got to end. It's time for this to stop. It's time for the United States government and all of its many iterations to come to serve the people who put it in power and who fund its existence, and get an America First agenda and not be a foreign policy tool for that little small country over there in, we call it Israel. Anyway, Palestine's a real name. Mm-hmm.
Now, David, General Galvin, former commander of U.S. European Command of NATO, told U.S. Congress that 150,000 U.S. troops will remain in Europe indefinitely for two purposes: to counter ethnic and nationalistic eruption in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet republics, and to be available for rapid deployment outside of Europe to counter a, quote, uncertain enemy. What does this signify? That NATO should always have an enemy, certain, uncertain? They need to create enemies in order to justify their raison d'etre?
Absolutely. There's very much of a self-fulfilling vicious circle here. You cannot have this level of weapons sales, this arming of the globe without enemies. Enemies are absolutely essential. And NATO is becoming a global imperial alliance of weapons customers, of largely U.S., but also French, U.K., other big weapons-producing countries' customers. NATO not only has all of these countries in Europe pushing ever eastward, but has these alliances with numerous other countries, potential future NATO members, and countries that are nowhere near the North Atlantic that are partnering with NATO. And this is seen, again, by a lot of people as somehow making things more legal, whereas this is not the United Nations. This is not a democratized United Nations. This is a military alliance. And you have people in the United States, from top politicians to academics to ordinary, who will say, what, would you abandon the world? Would you ignore and avoid and isolate the rest of the world rather than be in NATO? As if a death pact, as if a war pact were the only way to associate with other countries, as if you could not associate with other countries nonviolently, cooperatively, legally, as if you couldn't work on the problems we have no choice but to face, the environmental and disease and refugee and nuclear threats, rather than a military alliance that generates the problems, as in Ukraine, that it then claims to need to step in and solve.
Okay. Now, let's take a look at what's happening today, Mike. This Russia-Ukraine thing. And Russia has cited its own concerns, NATO's eastward expansion. It's been warning time and time again, but this is what happened. So how justified, in your opinion, are Russia's concerns regarding NATO's expansion and activities?
Well, in my opinion, Vladimir Putin and the Russian position on Ukraine, as well as the ongoing expansion eastward, is spot on. The U.S. caused the problem in Ukraine when Victoria Nuland spent $5 billion U.S. tax dollars to topple the duly elected, legitimately elected Viktor Yanukovych regime. And so since then, that's when these dominoes started to fall that's led us to this situation here. And this talk about allowing Ukraine into NATO is absurd, because James Baker made promises to Gorbachev that there would be no eastward expansion toward the Russian border. And then, of course, NATO and the U.S. broke every promise they've ever made. The bottom line is that the U.S. has become the villain of the world. And everything that they say is you can't trust them. I mean, our friends can't trust us. Our enemies can't trust us. So any word that they make, any commitment that they give is not to be believed. They're there to be, as Reagan said, trust but verify. No, don't even bother to trust the U.S. because they will betray you. They betrayed Saddam Hussein. They betrayed Manuel Noriega, who were both allies of the U.S. And they threw him under the bus. And the other guest, Mr. Swanson, was really correct. He's hinted around something. And that is, after World War II, the U.S. Defense contractors, the providers of these defensive and armament systems and platforms, they enjoyed making huge profits. They enjoyed it a lot. So they've engaged in ongoing skirmishes ever since the end of World War II. I mean, we're out of World War II a couple of years, and there's Korea. Then out a couple of years, and there's Vietnam. With the event of 9/11, they created the war in Afghanistan and Iraq. These companies have so much influence over U.S. policy, and they consume so much money through military spending that it is obscene. And the U.S. needs to wean itself off of the defense as an industry, as a national export here, and come up with something that is much more productive. Maybe retool these defense contractors for exploration of space, for instance. There's more money in that than there is in destroying life on this planet and destroying other countries. So the U.S. population has had about enough of this criminal regime that is in power now, and not just the Biden regime, but going back to George H.W. Bush, egregious mistakes have been made that damage American interests and damage the position of the American people. And they've lost the support of the population. That's as simple as I can put it. This country is really in trouble right now, and we're tottering on, open civil unrest. And I'd like to avoid that, but the U.S. government has got to stop its expansionist, imperialistic adventures overseas. And I never thought I would be the one to use the word imperialist, because I've always been virulently anti-communist. And for me to say these words and to see what the U.S. government is doing, it's really been an eye-opener for me and quite humbling, that the U.S. has got to stop what it's doing. It has to be a better global citizen than what it's been for the last 30, 40, 50 years, actually 70 years since the end of World War II.
Okay. Now, David, let's take a look at the reasons why NATO has been refusing calls, and some very desperate calls, as Zelensky was talking to the House of Commons in the U.K. today, to act against Russia. Is this a sign of weakness on the part of NATO, as Kiev puts it?
First of all, let's be very, very clear. Nothing can justify or make reasonable Russia's invasion and attack on the nation of Ukraine. Yes, Russia had perfectly reasonable demands for months leading up to, and NATO and the United States and Ukraine refused to meet them or even take them seriously. But that does not begin to justify mass murder, which is absolutely inexcusable, no matter who is engaging in it or why. Russia now has quite reasonable demands, and Ukraine refuses to take them seriously or to talk, and Zelensky rather nonsensically acts as if Russia is refusing to negotiate, while he himself refuses to say anything specific to suggest the possibility of meeting any demands or making any demands of his own. So, again, you have to have an enemy, and that enemy has to be an irrational madman that you can't talk with. Otherwise, you're going to have to talk with him or her or them. Right. This is the problem with the U.S. and Western influence on Ukraine and the position of the Zelensky government. There does not seem to be openness to anything other than escalation, and this risks nuclear apocalypse.
Now, Mike, let's turn to some prediction. What's future holding for security arrangement, especially in Europe, and for NATO given the fact that, you know, France and some other countries have been pushing for, you know, creating this European army. So what's going to happen to NATO?
Well, first I have to disagree with the other guest on one point that he made, that mass murder by the Russians of the Ukrainians. Understand that most of the Ukrainian people are of Russian descent and are very similar to the Russians who are coming in. They share a common language. They share a common genetic. I think Putin and the Russian armed forces have done an inordinately good job of trying to avoid civilian casualties. And so I want to disagree on that small point.
Stop bombing them. You'll avoid them altogether.
Well, no, I think you're misreading this here. And, I appreciate your perspective. However, I disagree with it. But the U.S. would not tolerate China putting something on the Mexican border. Russia should not tolerate it because, you know, the road into Moscow is right through Ukraine. So I think they have legitimate self-defense interests there that Putin is defending. Now, there is the issue here where the Ukrainian borders have never been articulated or defined going back to 1991. So there is a claim to be made that that is Russian territory still. And so there is a number of issues here. But to answer the question about what the future looks forward to, I kind of see that the Russians have the superior position right now because they can shut off all the oil and gas into Europe, and the Germans and many others are going to have a very long, cold winter. It's going to shut down their economy. It's going to shut down their industry. So there's a lot of other cards and a lot of other levers that Putin can use that don't require any military actions at all. Like the SWIFT system, if they're going to cut Russia out of the SWIFT system, then expect the oil and gas into Europe to go off, and for life in Europe to get very, very tough. But these are all escalations. And what we need to do is de-escalate the situation to avoid the situation. And from what I understand, the Russian view on this is more of a police action to remove the corruption from Ukraine that the West has put in there. Like I said, Victoria Nuland toppled the duly elected government and allowed Western corrupt interest to come in there, looking directly at Joe Biden and the millions that have been paid to his son through this Burisma thing. Biden wants Ukraine destroyed so he can destroy all the evidence of his bribery and everything else. Understand that Ukraine is the global nexus now for drug trafficking, for human trafficking of both women and children, and for arms trafficking. And so you understand these things. You understand the criminality, the corruption that exists in Ukraine. And if I was Vladimir Putin, I wouldn't want that next to my country either. So I think what he's doing is trying to protect the Russian people of Ukraine as well as protect Russia proper. And so I don't support violence. But I do support his position.
Except for the violence that you support.
Okay, unfortunately, that's all the time we have, gentlemen. Sorry for jumping. And let me thank our guests. We had David Swanson, director of the World Beyond War in Charlottesville, and Mike Harris, editor of the Veterans Today from Phoenix, Arizona, for their contribution. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Growing drive-by hardcore Trumpists spurs U.S. election watchdogs to voice alarm about threat to America's democracy. Here we present you an article written by Peter Stone. The piece is titled Bannon and Allies Bid to Expand Pro-Trump Influence in Local U.S. Politics. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Key Donald Trump loyalists Steve Bannon and Michael Flynn are at the forefront of a drive to expand Trumpist influence at the local level of U.S. politics, while forging ahead with efforts aimed at promoting baseless claims that Joe Biden's 2020 election victory was fraudulent. The growing drive by Trump's hardcore allies has spurred election watchdog groups to voice alarm about the threat to democracy posed by Michael Flynn and Steve Bannon, and other Trump acolytes, as they combine debunked claims about election fraud and calls for further 2020 election audits, with planning conservative takeovers of official positions that run U.S. elections. The moves come a year after the attack on the Capitol in Washington, when a pro-Trump mob invaded the building in an attempt to stop the certification of Joe Biden's election victory. Michael Flynn and Steve Bannon, using varying paths, have focused new energy on increasing conservative influence by recruiting more allies for key posts at the local and precinct level, with an eye on the 2022 and 2024 elections, and building more political alliances on issues such as vaccine requirements and mask mandates. The strategies Michael Flynn and Steve Bannon are deploying overlap those of other conservative outfits, such as the influential youth group Turning Point USA, to expand the pro-Trump base at the precinct level and work to elect Trump-backed politicians to key posts, such as Secretary of State in Georgia, in Arizona, and in various other battleground states. Michael Flynn and Steve Bannon have separately relied on a mix of non-profit groups, including one backed by the multimillionaire Patrick Byrne, conservative social media outlets favored by the far right, like Telegram, and events that convey evangelical Christian messages with political disinformation. Steve Bannon, for instance, has used his War Room podcast to espouse plans for taking over the Republican Party through the precinct committee strategy and invited would-be candidates to appear as guests. He claimed the podcast, which has millions of downloads, has found a large and receptive conservative following. Meanwhile, Michael Flynn touts the adage that local action has national impact and has been a star speaker in several key states at Reawaken America events, which are dubbed Health and Freedom conferences and combine evangelical themes with misinformation about the 2020 presidential election and vaccine skepticism. The conservative crusades by Michael Flynn and Steve Bannon come after Donald Trump pardoned them post-election for lying to the FBI and fraud, respectively. Steve Bannon and Michael Flynn also were central actors with other Trump loyalists in scheming about ways to block Congress from certifying Joe Biden's election, efforts that are under scrutiny as part of the House Select Committee investigation of the deadly Capitol attack by hundreds of Donald Trump supporters. As they have carved out new roles in the conservative ecosystem, Michael Flynn and Steve Bannon still support Trump's conspiratorial claims that he lost in 2020 due to massive cheating, a mantra that reinforces their drives to expand local and state electoral influence to give Republicans a better shot at recapturing Congress next year and the White House in 2024. Joanna Lydgate, chief executive of the state's United Democracy Center, said in a statement to The Guardian, "We're seeing a dangerous trend of election deniers lining up to fill election administration positions across the country." She added, "And the efforts by Michael Flynn, Steve Bannon and other promoters of the big lie are all part of this playbook to hijack elections in 2022 and 2024 if their preferred candidate doesn't win." Likewise, as they have revved up political work on multiple fronts, the two ex-Trump advisers have taken more extremist stances, sparking strong criticism. Michael Flynn, a retired Army Lieutenant General, has been skewed for his authoritarian-style advocacy of one religion for America, and for speaking at some events with heavy presences by adherents of QAnon conspiracy movement. Michael Flynn's call for one religion came during a talk to a conservative Christian audience in Texas on the Reawaken America tour last November. Michael Flynn said, "If we're going to have one nation under God, which we must, we have to have one religion. One nation under God and one religion under God, right? All of us working together." According to Patrick Byrne, the multimillionaire founder of America Project that counts Michael Flynn as special advisor and spokesperson, Flynn's feature role at Reawaken America meetings in several states such as Michigan and Florida is hardly an accident. Patrick Byrne, who has joined Michael Flynn at some Reawaken rallies, said in text messages that he and Flynn had a large hand in launching the Reawaken tour during the spring by bankrolling the events with some tens of thousands of dollars from the America Project. Overall, Byrne said that the America Project has raised about $9.5 million, of which he donated close to $7 million. Patrick Byrne and the America Project poured over $3 million into a months-long audit of Arizona's largest county, which Donald Trump was banking on to find major fraud, but which resulted in no significant changes to Joe Biden's win there or overall in the state, much to Donald Trump's dismay. Patrick Byrne said the project has helped promote audits in other states besides Arizona, boasting a net worth about $75 million. Byrne is the ex-chief executive of furniture retailer Overstock. Patrick Byrne texted that he didn't vote for Donald Trump and deems himself a rule of law advocate who claims there's still a mountain of evidence to support the widely debunked allegations of voter fraud. Patrick Byrne's project has had no dearth of Trump links. The project's president until late last month was Emily Newman, a former Trump aide. According to multiple reports, Emily Newman, along with Patrick Byrne and Michael Flynn, attended a meeting in December of 2020 with Donald Trump about ways to block Joe Biden taking office, where Michael Flynn touted the option of declaring martial law and deploying the military to rerun the election in key states that Donald Trump lost. Patrick Byrne said Flynn's brother, Joe Flynn, has succeeded Emily Newman as the project's president. On top of his work with the America Project, Flynn's focus on expanding the MAGA base at the local level increased when he became chairman in May of another non-profit, America's Venture, which in turn has partnered with Turing Point USA and others to form a larger alliance dubbed County Citizens Defending Freedom USA. According to Florida lawyer Ron Filipkowski, a former prosecutor who authored a Washington Post article on the wave of local drives by Trump backers, the County Citizens Group has sponsored an array of training programs, protests, and candidate meetings with a focus on mask mandates,
vaccine requirements, and critical race theory. For his part, Steve Bannon's heavy emphasis on a local precinct strategy to help Republicans' electoral fortunes combines conspiratorial and apocalyptic bravado. Steve Bannon told CNN in December that his War Room podcast is an organizing tool to expand Donald Trump's base. Bannon said, "It is about winning elections with the right people, MAGA people. We will have our people in at every level." Bannon said in November on his War Room podcast, "We're taking over all the elections. We're going to get to the bottom of last year's election and we're going to decertify the electors. And you're going to have a constitutional crisis. But you know what? We're a big and tough country and we can handle that. We'll be able to handle that. We'll get through that." Megan Squire, a computer science professor at Elon University, told The Guardian that much of Steve Bannon's political messaging has relied on alternative social media channels, such as Telegram, that appeal to conservative and far-right allies to spread pro-Trump gospel and help broaden the MAGA base at the local level. To Megan Squire, Steve Bannon's rhetoric and large audience look increasingly dangerous. Megan Squire said, "After being deplatformed from mainstream social media over the past year, Bannon has been promoting alternative, permissive social media channels such as Telegram and Get. There, his listeners are able to amplify and intensify Bannon's messaging into a 24-hour-a-day echo chamber filled with disinformation, scams, and conspiracy theories." For Joanna Lydgate, the chief executive of the state's United Democracy Center, the multi-front drives by Steve Bannon, Michael Flynn, and other key Trump loyalists pose serious risks for the integrity of future elections. She said, "They want to sow doubt in our democracy and make it easier to undermine the will of the American voters."
This is